and get healthy. Anyways, welcome aboard, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, Michael D. Shaw is here. I was just talking with Mike about that my daughter and I are doing this diet together. She wants me to do a vegan diet to detox. And I'm in it. You know, it's no animal products, no dairy, no sugar. I mean, no oils. And, you know, I feel good. I feel like I've eaten enough of that stuff all my life. And, you know, I'm not being orthodox about it. And then I'm not going to go through every label and see if there's like one little drop of sugar in something. But for the most part, I'm doing it and I feel quite good. And I'll keep you all posted on how I am.
How long have you been on it?
3 days. But, you know, I mean, I feel better. I mean, for the first day, I felt a little shaky, but it hasn't been hard. I thought that I'd be, you know, I really thought, oh, I have all cravings. But no, I'm fine. You know,
thing that might happen with a vegan diet is protein, B12. You have to watch stuff like that.
Yeah, let me just adjust something. I'm having a little sound problem here. All right, and I can fix it. I'm figuring out how to do this. I want to make sure that, let's just see. It's getting echoey. All right, where was my headphones? Let me just see. Make sure that I have got... Yeah, there we go. Okay, headphones are on. I shouldn't have a problem with that. All right, say something now.
All right.
There's that. I think that's better, isn't it?
Make America great again.
Say it again.
Make America great again.
Yeah, that's much better. And I want to keep sound quality happening here. All right, so speak up. Let me just hear another test.
All right. Well, you said the test. Okay.
All right.
So you have here as the topic of the show, Black Swan Event 2024.
Yes.
I think it's already a Black Swan Event that unprecedented, apparently, in the insurance industry in history. Someone has been asked to post a $400 million bond. Which no one will underwrite for obvious reasons, unless you come up with $1 billion in hard cash, which nobody really has. So the comment was made by Kevin O'Leary. At what point is adult supervision going to come in to this New York judicial system? Never mind the fact that Letitia isn't doing this on her own. She's got evil co-conspirators from the DNC helping her. I mean, there's no way they could have found this obscure law, apparently, of which you can defraud nobody but still commit fraud. So when is someone going to speak up? U.S. Supreme Court, New York Supreme Court, how bad does it have to get before the adults come in the room, assuming there are any adults?
This is a complete attack on America. I mean, it's an attack on New York City, which is the very heart of America's economy and which is supposed to be a crown jewel in this country. To have them come in and confiscate property for, like, you know, this alleged crime, which even if it were the case, would not be something that would warrant such an insane penalty on top of confiscating private property. It's communism, and it's something that I hope Americans are going to scratch their head over and say, gee, you know, I guess that the government can now come in and seize anything they want. This, combined with Peter Navarro going to prison for basically a misdemeanor that people have done all the time in terms of not showing up before Congress or pleading the Fifth or using other creative tactics, It completely throws out the window executive immunity, which means that anyone who serves a president of the United States or probably other executive offices can be charged with a crime and jailed for comments that they may have made. There is no more ability to function in those offices. It abrogates questions of corporate structure, where you have immunity clauses and you have confidentiality clauses within companies, and all sorts of other contract law. It is, these things are like black swans, and they all are done just because they have to take out Trump. This business of that witch, Carol, that woman, that would never have seen the inside of a courtroom if it wasn't for Trump. That crazy, ridiculous story, he attacked her in a public, and she made those same charges against other prominent men too. This would never, without any evidence, she couldn't even remember the year it happened, it would never have made the inside of a courtroom. But the fact that it did, and then they're charging him not only for that, but for standing up for himself, it is a complete attack on free speech. It is a complete attack on the ability to, if this is possibly, putting aside Trump here, because that's obviously what's happening, it's the ultimate result of the slide into hate crimes, which are penalizing speech, penalizing opinion. Regardless of how horrible we may think an opinion is, people have a right to them in this country. It's not a crime to express an opinion. And it's just all of these things are direct assaults on our American system. And to go to this level of depravity in order to defeat an opponent, which in and of itself is the kind of thing that we thought only used to happen in communist countries, where the opponent is put in jail, the opponent is imprisoned, their opposition is all jail, people are swept up, and people are censored openly and bugged openly and spied on openly. And you have situations where segments of the population are spied on. This is what Lenin did when he set up the Cheka. We have to get the kulaks. We have to get, this group and that group. And he'd send them out and spy on them, and much worse in that case. Now they're spying on Catholics at church. They're spying on parents going to school board meetings. They're spying on anyone who doesn't goose step to their point of view. So yeah, it is a gigantic black swan, and it's really taking place right now and right as we speak.
Well, a couple of things come out of this, which are, of course, quite depressing. All right, I asked earlier, where's the adult supervision? And I suppose the answer to that is, well, these things have to make their way through the process, which I don't understand, but that's the excuse. The other thing is that you ask yourself, how did we get to this point? You raise the notion of, quote, hate crimes, which I've never understood, by the way. Okay, the word hate crime was invented when that poor guy from Texas, I forget his name, was dragged in the back of a truck and was killed in that
Bird. Yeah, James Bird. He was dragged behind a truck with chains. And then you had I don't know who the ad guy was, some marketing genius, put a commercial together with the daughter talking over this horrible video, blaming George W. Bush for this, because he was governor at the time. Talk
well,
about
here's
like
the question.
Yeah.
How is the guy any more dead because it's a hate crime? Now, I can see that because of the heinous nature of a crime like that, you go directly to the death penalty. But the trouble is, there aren't that many murders that are committed out of love. So at least love for the victim.
Right.
So once you open up this term hate crime, then you created a worse situation with these hate crime hoaxes that started appearing.
Oh, yeah. And also, by the way, Bush, he was asked about it. He said, look, we've implemented the ultimate hate crime law, the death penalty.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, this is, the fact that somebody's motivated by hate, of course they are. But that motivation is only relevant in the course of a trial to prove intent. When you have a trial of someone, you know, yeah, you bring up, gee, they have something against black people or they got something, you know, that's evidence. But the actual act of having those sentiments itself is not a crime. It is used as evidence to prove a crime.
Well, exactly. I mean, what if the white guys that did it had dragged a white guy behind their truck?
Right.
Would that have not been hate crime?
That's right. And yeah.
So what happens also, though, is when you look at this Trump thing and you look at the weaponization of government and you look at human history, you have to come to the very unhappy conclusion that most people, I guess, would prefer living under an autocratic dictatorship because they seem to not worry about free speech. They seem to not realize that these bizarre measures taken against Donald Trump or Peter Navarro could just as easily been taken against them. I mean, the fact that it didn't occur, Eric Holder committed worse contempt of Congress than Navarro.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was held in contempt of Congress. Nothing happened. It wasn't even brought up. I saw him the other night on with Bill Maher, and that subject wasn't even raised. Right. But yes, I mean, of course, he committed, he was cited for contempt of Congress. It was the first time a sitting attorney general had been cited in that manner, I think probably ever, but maybe ever. Certainly in modern times. But, what was much worse than Navarro basically protecting presidential immunity. And whether Navarro's right or wrong here, the fact is that what he did was a misdemeanor, not something you go to prison for 4 months.
Yeah, that's offender, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's unprecedented. And, right, I mean, look, we could point to a lot of, pleading the fifth could be seen as contempt of Congress. It was a method that was devised by a lawyer in the 1920s to help the mafia.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's a relatively new innovation. But I only point out that, these are the kinds of things that have happened. And to put, it's never been responded to by prison sentences, certainly not for former cabinet members or former executive office members in the past. I mean, we're not talking here about somebody, this isn't Al Capone. I mean, this is like, it's just the heavy-handedness of it is really, really scary, and it's starting to really ramp up. Now that it does appear that Trump is probably going to win, there's evidence that the left now knows he's going to win. One piece of evidence I think that's interesting is that they're trying to force Sonia Sotomayor to step down from the Supreme Court because she's in very poor health. Apparently she has a group of doctors who literally follow her around with infusions, and she's got serious diabetes and some other things. And they just feel like, hey, if Trump is, we want you out for the same reason they try to push Ruth Bader Ginsburg out. They don't want Trump to win and then she dies. So that tells me they know Trump's going to win. The thing is that it's just going to get ugly, though. I mean, they're not going to sit by quietly.
No, I mean, the silver lining of that, as I alluded to in the current piece on Substack, is that as they get more and more and more desperate, there's no hiding anymore. So they get exposed. I mean, not that it's a surprise to you or me, as just outright evil scoundrels. And that's fine. But the thing that's depressing to me as a world-class cynic is the absurd tribalism exhibited by so many people that, for reasons unknown, other than that apparently they've been taught, they have to hate Trump and can't take themselves under the equation to see, no, he really shouldn't have to forfeit his real estate holdings, even without appeal, on this ridiculous trial that he's involved in. But there are people who are so partisan, and not just the media, that it's like they're completely invested in this, which I've never understood.
It's very bizarre.
You're in the belly of the beach there, in the Brookline area. Probably 99.999% of the people are liberal. So if you go to your local grocery store, how does it make their life better if Donald Trump were to drop dead or get thrown in jail for 100 years? How does it improve their life?
Well, it's nothing to do with that. Well, actually, I mean, since looking at my own local Brookline, Boston, Cambridge world here, there are people who are sitting up and supporting Trump and doing so with, I mean, I'm seeing people take steps. It's interesting. You know, you get suddenly someone showing up. Yeah, right out. I was at an event recently. A guy had a MAGA hat on, you know, and they're like, yes, we're for Trump. And it's really kind of interesting. I've had people mention it to me, you know, Soto Voce, but there is definitely people who are starting to come out after all these years of the Trump hatred propaganda and the brainwashing. There are people who are starting to wake up. Now, the bulk of these people, I mean, I see them in two categories. First of all, you have the fully witting, fully conscious people like Mark Elias, right? And Weissman and, Lawrence Tribe and that jerk in Hollywood, what's his name, Meathead, you know, from All in the Family. I mean, these people are fully witting, conscious conspirators. They don't like Trump for real reasons. They don't like this country. They don't like an assertion of American sovereignty. They don't want to have, you know, a closing of the borders or a regulation. They don't want to have American culture come back, the English language to come back. They view America as a province of the world. They're socialists. They're part of this kind of, this idea that the state is all powerful, not God. They're atheists. They're hardcore leftists. They hate Trump because Trump is a threat to their way of life, clearly. More so than I think any figure who's come on in our lifetime. And he is the head of a movement that threatens to wake people up and that threatens their whole nexus of corrupt power and their interlocking informal control through their corporations and their media control and their secret societies and their money and all the rest. So yeah, they hate Trump and they want to take him out. But that's only a tiny group. The vast majority of people, the people that I know in my life who are not witting, who are not conscious, and who I believe have been tampered with mentally through methodologies that have been in place for a while. It's the same methodologies that tampered with the German mind during the rule of Hitler. You know, it's these powerful structures know how to manipulate people's emotions and minds in a way that they don't know why they are who they are. They don't know what it is they're doing. I mean, if you ask some of these people, can you please explain to me exactly what it is that you hate Trump so much for? They can't answer that. Right. They fall apart into a babbling bowl of jelly. I mean, they cannot articulate anything in particular. He was against, the Muslim ban, you know, some crazy crap like that, you know, some lie that they digested a while ago. You know, he said that all the people were good people. They don't know why, and they can't explain it because they haven't, there's something, their brains have been tampered with by the use of this, I mean, I call it almost like Chinese water torture from the media. Bing, bing, every day, little drops on the head, bing, bing. And they just have basically been conditioned. It's very Pavlovian in a way. Pavlov's dogs, right?
It is, but you would think that at least a percentage of them, when confronted with that, and then in a private moment saying, hey, you know what, this is completely irrational, But you're saying that itself is part of the conditioning, that you, there's no self-reflection about it, right? You've just Pavlovian response, MK Ultra, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
MK Ultra.
We come back to my favorite question, which no one seems to be able to answer ever. Who watches network news anymore?
Well, it's not just the network news, and it still has influence. It's like nobody really actually reads the New York Times, but the New York Times still sets the stage for what people think. It still tells us how we are to think about things, what we are to think about, and what we're not to think about, because it goes to every newsroom in the country. It goes to every media outlet, TV, radio, and print. And they all read it and get their marching orders every single day. So
all
even
right.
if the...
Okay, but you're right, except how many mistakes do they have to make? How many plagiarists have to be unmasked at Harvard before some of this reputation starts to disintegrate? I mean, New York Times has been terrible at least since the 1930s, and probably even during the Civil War, with your friend Walter Durrani, pro-Stalin, and then Herb Matthews, pro-Castro, in the 50s and 60s.
Yep.
So the New York Times has a pretty long history of being wrong. I dare say that there are very few people alive who can even go back as far as Walter Durrani, let's say, writing this stuff in 1932. So where is this paradigm that they, I understand they are influential, but at what point does that break down? At what point does break down?
It's so pervasive, and it has its tentacles in so many areas of American life and thought and mind. That, you know, it's up, you know, you mentioned Harvard, all of academia has been co-opted, I think, going way back. I think it goes back to the early part of the 20th century, actually, when German education, you know, the colleges all decided that they wanted to offer PhDs, and they decided to develop this elite establishment. Woodrow Wilson's an example as a professor. They adapted the German system, the Prussian system, which emanated from Hegel and from other philosophers, which rather than the American system, which is based on the biblical idea, the Lockean idea, John Locke, the idea that rights come from the individual and that the individual has agency, to this idea that the state has a divine right. The Germans believe that, and Hegel believed that the state has its own life. It's almost like a human being.
Yeah.
And that was furthered by Oswald Spengler, who I think was an English philosopher in the late 19th century, this idea that the state is a redemptive force, it's a divine force, and it's kind of a modernization of the idea of the divine right of kings.
Divine right of kings, right.
And that the academia went to Europe to get their education, and they came back, and you had people like John Dewey, the so-called father of the so-called modern education, and the frontier thinkers. I remember reading about this from Sam Blumenfeld's books. I'm still studying his books. He's brilliant. And they brought back this idea, which was completely anathema to the American idea of individualism and the individual under God. You know, that we derive our rights from the creator and not from the state. So you have this idea that the ideal is a collectivist state run by these brilliant intellectuals. They can be as wrong as hell. They don't care. I mean, that's why, you know, the New York Times can be dead wrong. I mean, they were wrong during World War II when they were pro-Nazi, right?
Yeah.
They hid
yeah.
this young woman at Harvard, actually, who did a thesis on this, a doctoral thesis. I forget the name of it. It was published years ago, where she showed that the New York Times covered up anything to do with the Holocaust during the war. They either didn't write about it or they put it on the very back page. They chose to do that because that was a social experiment that was being conducted by the international elite at the time. And, you know, whatever it is that's going on, it's like We've talked about how they invented gay marriage in a New York boardroom. I think I've talked about how
Anthony Lewis.
Yeah, Anthony Lewis and Pollock wrote a book about this. The late, I forget his name. I actually knew him. He was a supporter of my campaign, in full disclosure. What was his name? Pollock. Edward Pollock. Ed Pollock, yeah. He was the founder of Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly, which became the New England Lawyers Weekly, which eventually went national. Very successful businessman. And he wrote a book about how the New York Times invented gay marriage in a boardroom, and that they sent Anthony Lewis out to propagandize this in Boston, write columns extolling the virtues of gay marriage, something that no one had heard of in the late 1980s when they launched it. And most gay people hadn't heard of it. They were scratching their heads. I mean, like, what? You know, it was kind of like out of the blue. It was a manufactured thing. Then, of course, in 2003, you had the state Supreme Court judicial court decision in Massachusetts legalizing gay marriage in Massachusetts, authored by Margaret Marshall, who was the wife of Anthony Lewis.
Yeah, convenient. Right?
Yeah, talk about a conflict of interest. So I'm just saying the New York Times cooked this whole thing up. They literally had a board meeting where Punch Schultzberger, the younger, said, we're going to do this. Here's how we're going to do it. He had came in with a PowerPoint presentation. We're going to go here. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. This is going to be the new social issue. We're going to market it as a civil rights issue. And we're going to normalize it. And it's going to be something we're going to do it over this period of time. And they just did it. I mean, everybody, because of their influence in the inner workings of boardrooms, cultural institutions, media institutions, they all followed suit. Even if they did it subconsciously, they followed suit. I mean,
what was Sulzberger's dog in that fight? Was he closet gay? Or I mean, was he promoting?
I think that he's as a leftist, he was excited over the idea of creating social change. Right? Now the same people are doing surgeries on removing children's testicles and vaginas without parental consent. This is the latest. This is the pushing the envelope, of course.
Okay. Here again, if I can interrupt, you have to ask, where's the adult supervision? All right.
And well, the adults are all been conditioned by the same education
AMA and the Pediatric Association came out in favor of mutilation surgery, then you knew the jig was up.
It's seen as the most cutting edge social issue. I mean, we have here in Boston a local Reform synagogue. I'm not going to mention which, that they've decided to spend all of their meager funds on replacing the prayer books with a gender neutral prayer book. Takes out any reference to male or female, and I mentioned this to an ultra liberal person that I happen to know. And I thought how ridiculous that is. And this ultra-liberal person responded to me by saying, well, you know, there was a time when women weren't mentioned in the prayer book, which is untrue, of course. But, you know, now women can be praying in the synagogue and they're not separated and they can be rabbis. And my response to that is that, first of all, when the prayer books added women were, they were adding something. You know, women are in the Torah, the book of Genesis. God created men and women in his image.
Well, there are any number of heroic women in the Old Testament.
Of course. I mean, and the point is that, you know, you can get into an argument over the intricacies of it. Should women be rabbis? Okay, fine. That's a debate. Should priests be women? Women be priests. But the point is that they were adding something rather than what they're doing now, which is they're subtracting, they're removing both men and women from the literature, from the liturgy, from the actual, you know, what we think of as the Word of God. I mean, it's not only is it sacrilegious, but it's false. It's just not dealing with reality. They've decided men and women no longer exist.
And I think what's going in that case, and it sounds like some ultra-reform synagogue.
It is. It is.
Is they're worshiping each other, and God is out of the picture.
Well, yeah, they don't believe. I mean, there was another ultra-reform synagogue, this was years ago, that published a Seder Haggadah, for you read it at the Seder table in Passover, and they laboriously went through the exercise of expunging any mention of God, right? I'm like, why have it? Well, that's what my sense of. Why have it? Do you need to have matzo ball soup or something? I mean, you don't. You need to. You know, what's the sense of this? I mean, it gets to be that ridiculous. And they would go around and they retrain their brains so that they could talk about these things without mentioning the word God. Now they can't mention the word man or woman. They can't mention the word father or mother. You know, these things are now, you know, you can't do that because you might offend somebody, or because, more fundamentally, because they believe that they're involved in transforming man. I mean, this is the ultimate leftist dream. They're going to recreate a new kind of a human being, Homo Sovieticus, right? I mean, they're going to create, right, this new being.
Wasn't that what Hitler wanted to do?
Of course. The Übermensch.
Yeah.
The Übermensch, you would get rid of people who would not bred properly, and you would create a Superman, blonde hair, blue eyes, can live to be 200, perfect health, you know, and also, by the way, cosmic consciousness, right? Somebody who knew the universe, somebody who could be like God, actually, you know, sort of the sin of the Garden of Eden. You can be as God, you can know good and evil, you can overthrow God. So that's what it's about.
And they're completely unaware of the fact that they're emulating these totalitarian movements, coming very close to the Nazi ideology.
Well, this whole thing about, with Hegel worshiping the state, I mean, I think that Hegel in many ways is misunderstood, because I think he also had some great things in his mind and in his philosophy, but this was an interpretation of Hegel that not only led to Marxism, but also led to this national socialist idea, this idea that the state, rather than individuals, can have a redemptive force in the universe. The state is a vehicle to change man, to change the nature of human beings. And that's why the state is spending now something like $6 billion on genital mutilation for children. And that it's a virtue to not tell the parents about it, because the parents don't know any better. It kind of kills two birds with one stone. They get to, you know, cut up a child, like a turkey on the Thanksgiving table, and they get to screw the parents by undermining the authority of the family. There's one case recently, by the way. I can't quote it. And I'm pretty sure it was in this country. It might have been Canada, because Canada's gone. But these parents refused to call their son or daughter by the other gender name, and the child was taken away.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you know the case I'm talking about. And it was upheld by a high court that the state had a right to take away the child from them. Is this what we're coming to? You can lose your children. I mean, thank God my daughter's old enough now. I mean, you know, she's an adult. But, I mean, I can imagine, the people who have young children at home, you have to worry about this kind of thing where you might get a knock on the door and say, I'm sorry, but you violated these new rules, and we're taking away your child. People, you might shake your head, but this is happening. And it's probably going to happen more.
With the full faith and credit of all the institutions that are supposed to be in charge, if you see the abuses that are happening to Trump in various states, the fact that this isn't laughed off the stage is pretty depressing.
It's very, very bad.
So, on the other hand, he's the guy that's willing to take the abuse. And interesting that we're coming up upon Easter and so on, but there is a slight analogy to be made that somebody is becoming, I hope we won't get to that point, but in many ways the sacrificial lamb of all the abuses that are going on by the state. And there's not very many voices, let's be honest, speaking out against it. Very few people in government that are saying anything.
Yeah, where is all the liberal, the left-wing liberals who were railing against this stuff years ago? You know, this guy Russ Baker, I've been trying to get him on my show. He won't come on with me now, but he's a left-winger who issues reports. He's railing against the FBI for years, the authoritarians, right? And COINTELPRO, when they went after the Black Panthers and they're spying on people, and J. Edgar Hoover and all. He won't talk to me now, because they've all on that side. They're all in with that now. They're all about it.
Well, they always were totalitarians. The problem back then was they were in the minority. So they were allegedly in favor of civil rights, which, by the way, they never were. That was complete
scam. Well, they were into it then because they didn't control the mechanisms of power.
Yeah.
Now they do.
So I would wonder how many people, regardless of political affiliation, are really okay with all this. I don't know what the percentage is, but you certainly can't go by people that write comments on blogs. On the other hand, it's absolutely amazing how people will take as a proof of their argument, well, look, you know, Trump has been indicted for blah, 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 therefore he must be a bad guy, and not seeing the outrageous abuses of this system. I don't know. I was never, and I've mentioned this before, I was never a fan of the criminal justice system that's been totally perverted, probably going back to the war on drugs. So yes. It all deteriorated, and now they're just placeholders doing these jobs. What I was really surprised about when this Judge Engoron case began.
Yes.
And you may have noticed this. I've been in several courtrooms, but I've never seen a judge sitting next to his little girl there helping him right at his at his side.
Yeah, his chief clerk, who's there, yeah. taking selfies with Schumer.
Yeah.
At a fundraiser. I mean, that's, you know, and then Trump brings it up, and all of a sudden, oh, he has to be gagged for mentioning this because it's too threatening to her. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know if
course.
You caught that part of this.
Oh yeah, and then let's mention that a few days ago, Justice Katami Jackson Brown or Brown
yeah.
Jackson actually made the statement that you're arguing against the government's ability to censor social media. Well, that would be, you know, hamstring the power of the government. And obviously that's what the First Amendment is about. So it is not an accident that they were filling the Supreme Court with this woman who's an imbecile. All right.
Yeah. And I mean, everybody knows it. Of course you can't say that. I mean, that you're basically picking people based on things other than their abilities to actually function.
Well, here's the thing about that, you know that's true, I know that's true, but then you take it to the next level, because I've had this argument regarding items in healthcare and how Medicare destroyed the healthcare system. And I would argue that it was intentional. It was intentional.
Right.
They knew
they want time down.
But nobody really wants to go there. They would rather say, well, it was a good intention. We were taking care
yeah,
of
it. Yeah, now that Boeing has doors flying off in midair,
yeah.
they're going to have to go there pretty soon, because they're the people
yeah.
that fly the most. And ultimately, you know, you don't want to go down in flames in that way. And, you know, Boeing probably is, I don't know this, but I get the sense that they're probably trying to get a high EKG score with BlackRock and Fidelity and the other companies that basically direct investments in their way. you know, and they look at those things. They look at how what your points are in social score, which means how left wing you are, or they look at you know, the environmental stuff. And if you score, you don't score high enough, you don't get the nod when the brokers have their meeting with their clients and they make suggestions on investment. So yeah, I mean, so what they do, they hire people
by being a good company.
That's right. I mean, it's, I don't give a, I mean, I want to know that they're putting the plane together properly. I don't care what somebody looks like. I don't care whether they have a vagina. I want them to have good engineers. I mean, Boeing used to be a company that had the best engineering, the best scientists, the best workers. They didn't give a damn what someone looked like. This is life and death. I mean, they're putting together airplanes. Who cares what they, I mean, they could get away with this maybe in a women's studies class, fine. But this is, you know, hospitals. I mean, you want to have a doctor, you're going to go under the knife. You want to have the best person, the best educated, the most accomplished person that there is. Well, I don't give a crap what they look like.
You would think so, but now it goes back to the old Stalinist Walter Duranty thing, that if you're going to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs.
Yeah.
So they really don't care, and people don't get this. They don't care that DEI...
No, I mean, even as Ketanji Brown, apparently she's so dumb, with due respect, that when she wrote the minority opinion, the dissenting opinion, and I think I've mentioned this, on the Harvard case, Harvard versus the Asian Society of right. Students, which Harvard lost. And I think she was, there was only one or two judges that were against that. I think ironically, it was Jackson and Sotomayor, who's another genius, with due respect. But she wrote the opinion was so juvenile that you would think that the left would have grabbed that thing, or they would have run it up the flagpole like it was the Sermon on the Mount. It would have been on the front pages of every news. We would never heard the end of it. But even they didn't mention it because it was so bad. It was filled with grammatical errors and misspells, and the reasoning was so like, it could have been written by like a college, first year college student turning in a paper. It was just so shoddy. I mean, she basically, the gist of her argument is, we need to keep affirmative action in place because there is still racism in the world. Really? I mean, that's what, you know, it's like, what? You know, I mean, everybody, so the whole thing was ignored. And yet there she is.
Well, what was funny about that, too, is that there's a certain amount of arrogance attached to that. Because not only is she stupid, she's one of these rare stupid people that don't realize they're stupid, which is rare. Okay.
Yeah.
But understand that she has available clerks that could have helped her write that.
Exactly. And what are they like?
Yeah, well,
I mean, it was a complete embarrassment. I would have thought that John Roberts, as treasonous as he is, quite frankly, might have taken a look at the thing before it was issued.
Now, he's a total toy boy.
Yeah,
and I always hated that guy even before he wrote One Decision.
I know, he's the worst.
And it was based on the very simple thing: as a guy who's been in corporate America, I've always hated people whose entire reason for being was polishing their resume.
And he's pretty open about that. All he seems to care about, what kind of a image are we going to have? What kind of a legacy are we going to have? Not what the Constitution says, not what the law says, what is best for the preservation of the judicial system. It's all like, how are we going to be remembered? Am I going to be the next John Marshall? I mean, what the hell? You're right, it's a complete careerist.
Well, yeah, and my experience with people like that in the corporate world have been, almost without exception, these people with these glowing resumes were actually terrible.
Oh, yeah, usually.
When you put them into a real-world situation to solve real-world problems, they couldn't do it.
Back in the day when I used to have liberals, professors, and credentialed people come on my various radio programs, they would be huffing and puffing, and there's the Shlomo and Betty Schlossberg chair, and the Mitzi Boosy Soupsy chair of the so-and-so, and they would come on the show, and I would ask one mild little direct question, and they would completely blow up.
Right.
Everything would, the whole, it would be like, I mean, you know, they would absolutely have a meltdown, you know. And occasionally I would have situations where they would ask me in advance, what am I going to ask? They would try to control, which I don't do, you know.
Yeah.
To me, it's like we have a conversation and we're going to see where it goes. I don't want to be told in advance that, recently, the only time this has happened recently, actually from E. Michael Jones tells me, I need to know what the category is in advance. And then when I told him what it was going to be, he didn't like it. And he said, no, it has to be this. He's going to dictate to me. You have to say that we only will talk about Israel's genocide. That's what I'm going to talk about. Yeah. I mean, I just, that's not how I roll. I'm not going to agree in advance to, you know, it's, what is this? I mean, you know, first of all, it's my show. And if you don't like the category, don't come on. Anyway.
Now funny I got that you mentioned that, because when I had that Health News Digest column, essentially every column, and there were, my God, close to 1,000 of them over time, nearly every one involved an interview with somebody. And there were two cases where they insisted on the questions in advance, and so I said, no, we're not going to do that. And in one case, they refused to do it. The other case, it was through an agency, and then the woman came to me directly and said, yeah, she'll do it. But that's what these people want. And it's funny you mentioned these endowed chairs, because that doesn't mean as much as people think it means. Because, you know, the Naomi Schlossberg endowed chair may have been awarded originally in 1920, and the heirs funding it. And at one point, I was involved very peripherally with an award, not a chair, but an award at a university that was done in the name of my grandmother. And it, I guess, was a big deal at first. And then you could see it was just a money grab for the university.
Right.
It didn't mean anything, you know, because you had no control over it. So they decided, okay, we decide the award's going to go to so-and-so. We don't know who this person is. It doesn't matter. And then when it came down to my generation and my brother and I were asked to fund it, and we're like, no.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a money grab. No, that's what these things are. You know, it's another attempt to bilk a few bucks, and then they have an award ceremony. They charge $1,000 a plate. You know, that's how they roll.
Well, I mean, there's a funny story about that. An undergrad, I went to UCLA, and the music department. A building was called Schoenberg Hall, after Arnold Schoenberg, the famous composer.
Mm-hmm.
So in the environment of fundraising, it ended up that you could get anything at the university named after you, anything, a drinking fountain.
Right.
Probably not.
You cough up enough dough. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But maybe, so it didn't matter what it was. So they went to David Geffen. They talk about being clueless. I went to David Geffen.
Yeah.
And said, well, David, you know, if you give $20 million, we'll name the music school after you, right? So this is all going through. And then the relatives and heirs of Schoenberg say, no, you can't do that. Because when UCLA was founded, essentially, the Schoenberg family made a gift, and it's Schoenberg Hall and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't even realize that. So that is why the medical school is named after David Geffen, because they had to give him something for his $20 million.
Right.
So it's just a huge money grab. Doesn't mean a thing. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Geffen is interested in healthcare and so on, but that wasn't his first choice.
Well, I mean, yeah, and it's, I mean, this is like, I don't know the details. I'm not even going to mention the college here in Boston where this happened. But this young man, the student, was involved in a rape accusation. And the father came in, super rich, big name. And before you know it, everything's swept under the rug and there's a building named after him. So I don't know, you know, these. Anyway, yeah. But.
So that was, but I mean, it perhaps when these endowed chairs started, they may have meant something at that time, that they went through a whole selection.
Right.
They found Professor so-and-so, and he was given the endowed chair. But the only advantage of an endowed chair to the university is they don't have to pay the salary of that guy. That's it. That's all that it's about.
Sure. And a lot of these big money combines, eventually the heirs take over, you know, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller organizations, the Carnegies. They're all taken over, not that they may or not always have been, but they are taken over by left-wingers who then use the funds to fund their pet projects and their friends, their politicians. And it just contributes to this advancement of this amorphous, unelected, you know, what Steve Bannon calls the administrative state, what Michael J. Glennon calls the double government. You know, this is all, it really started to pick up and build up a lot of steam with the Wilson administration and with yeah. the implementation of Wilson, who was an avowed socialist. And, you know, the passage of the 16th Amendment, which is the direct taxation, one of the little clauses of that, besides forcing every American who earns a few bucks to file a report to the government so you know they know what you're doing, was that it created the foundations and the nonprofits, which would be given tax exemptions, and which would thus, the wealthy would be able to park their money there so that they could employ their layabout children and their do-nothing relatives, and at the same time contribute to left-wing causes and build this infrastructure of an informal American aristocracy, eventually went worldwide.
Rockefeller Foundation is infamous, of course, for supporting the so-called research of Alfred Kinsey.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're into eugenics, population control, control of education, you know, all of it. I mean, it's a rotten, you know, bad, you know, the, you know, phonics. I mean, getting rid of phonics. All of it, you know, the Dewey program of progressive education, which replaced cognitive learning with behaviorism, and all the rest. I mean, it's all corrupting. So we wonder why it is the parents don't care that their children are having their sexual organs mutilated without behind their back. This is the end result, and I mean, parents, they don't care. I know someone in my own community. I'm not going to mention names, who actually is a doctor who is involved in this.
Yeah.
And he is very, very righteous about it. He speaks, you know, he delivers sermons at a particular religious institution, which I'm not going to mention. Huh. You know, it's appalling. I mean, he knows that I know the score and I don't talk to him at all. I mean, you know, he won't go anywhere near me, but people stole his virtues. He's cutting off the penises of children. Nobody cares. They think it's something, there's some virtue to this.
Well, I mean, it's like this creation of this virtue thing doesn't go away. I mean, I mentioned Kinsey. It only came out, by the way, in, what, 10, 15 years ago, when Judith Reisman wrote her book about Kinsey.
Yes.
And boy, she would have been great on your show.
She was died. On my show many times. I didn't know that.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I love Judith. I have archives of Judith, and she was brilliant.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Judith Reisman was really exposed. She made a difference in the world. She's a great, great woman.
Yeah. I mean, so the point being, though, that the abuse of these kids, including rape of 1 to 2 year old children.
Oh yeah, horrible. It was absolute.
But here's the tough part. There still is a building at University of Indiana named after Kinsey.
Yeah, and it has in its archives his entire collection of porn that is not available to the public. And, you know, he's talking about, I mean, and he completely Rockefeller funded. They marketed him like you'd market a can of peas. I mean, Mr. America with a bow tie, and they put him on the cover of Time magazine. Yeah. And the guy was, to say he was a pervert is really an understatement. You know, I mean, he, and his books, the American Male and the American Female, were used by courts to make decisions on these matters. I mean, it became like the Bibles of, it was ingrained. And for men, he interviewed homosexuals and prisoners. And for women, he interviewed prostitutes and would go and do surveys. And this reflects your average American male and female, right?
And the thing that helped it was in that era, no one seemed to question academia at all. I mean, I wrote a story about a woman that worked for some guy, and I believe it was Iowa. It was in the Midwest. It's a story I wrote a long, long time ago, and they were doing these horrible experiments on children.
Yeah.
That had to do not with sex, but the guy posited that you could create a lifelong stutter problem in a kid by constantly correcting him and harassing him as he's learning to speak. And indeed, that's what happened. They had a group of orphans that they divided into, and one they encouraged, the other they correct him. So virtually 100% of the group they harassed became lifelong stutterers. The graduate student who worked on the program had some bad thoughts about it after a while and attempted to fix these kids. Why she engaged in such crap, God only knows, but that was the state of academia back then. But there's a building.
It's very Pavlovian, you know, right? The dog would salivate after a while, even though there was no food, but he would hear the bell. You know, they'd ring a bell and then they'd get food. They'd ring a bell and then they'd get food. And then after a while, they would ring the bell and there was no food, but he would still salivate. You know, that was the gist of Pavlov's experiment.
Well, the whole thing, too, with quote, research. By calling something research, apparently it gives it an air of distinction. And on one of the American Council of Science and Health forums I was on, I happen to make fun of something called, and you may have heard of this because you're on a new diet now, the glycemic index. I don't know if that really developed. It was a university in Australia came out with this. And what they do is they take normal people, non-diabetic, they give them a single food and monitor their blood sugar for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So a higher glycemic index means that it's going to jump your blood glucose quickly,
right?
Which is sort of obvious. All right. The reason, and I attack this, is it is, yes, research, because you got subjects to do it, but it has no applicability in the real world. If someone eats bread, for example, they're probably going to have butter or something with it. They're certainly not going to only eat one slice of bread and not anything for 2 hours.
Right.
And how is that going to help a diabetic anyway? Because they're going to have elevated glucose for more than 2 hours. So, but I was actually severely attacked on this forum. Well, you're crazy because this is legitimate research. I said, yes, it's research.
It's bad research.
It didn't work, but it's pointless.
Well, it's just, I mean, that's the abuse of statistics anyways in research. I mean, it's very difficult to pinpoint something in its proper context. You have to open the lens. I mean, that's like, you know, you're looking at a snapshot of a particular thing at a particular place at a particular time to the point where it's, as you say, it's not relevant. It doesn't really mean anything, you know, in the broader picture. There are so many other factors and it's usually so complicated that you know, you're basically throwing away the reality, and you're throwing away the individual and their own unique element.
So it never seemed to occur to anybody in this Kinsey work. Forget the fact that he was a pervert. That the population being studied was homosexuals, prisoners, and prostitutes.
And the thing is that Kinsey hid that. That was not known until Riesman. Judith Riesman blew the lid off of all of that and exposed what actually was going on.
She
was. And she was a legitimate doctor. I think she actually was into sexology. She had a degree in it. You know, she had the credentials. But that wasn't until like 2001, 2002 when she started to write her books. So we're talking about, you know, 50 years where Kinsey's research was held up as this is science, right? Everything is science. That, you know, and you're questioning science by questioning Kinsey. After all, this is what the statistics show.
Right.
It was a complete fraud. It was just a, not even, it wasn't just bad research. It was fraudulent research. That was not a reflection of American society, of any society. It was a reflection of a very specific slice of people. That would be like going into, I don't know, some ultra left-wing district and interviewing people and saying, well, this is America. I mean, you know, no, it's a very specific group of people.
Well, the sad point is that if you go on places like American Council of Science and Health, I'm afraid that many that get on those forums have this worship of, quote, science without looking at what's behind this, you know.
Well, it's bad science. It's politicized science. I mean, I think we all worship science in the broad sense in terms of a quest to find out what's true, but and to advance, you know, human knowledge so we can get better medicines, we could get better refrigerators, whatever it is. But they're doing quack science.
Yeah.
That's not real science, that's politics. And it's a very specific kind of politics to get to a specific result that they preordained. Anyways, there's a lot, we're sort of reaching the end, but I just want to say that there's a lot coming out now, finally, not that it hasn't gradually trickled out, about the COVID vaccine and about the whole rotten COVID hoax, frankly. And I think there are some congressional hearings that are bringing things out. There is some other information coming out about the death toll of it, the number of people who have died from it. And I think we just have to keep an eye on that one, because that could be the biggest story of the past past century, at least. If and when it really does come out.
As more and more stuff leaks out, or drips out, if you want to say, it may take some time. People are going to have to, they're going to come to the conclusion, which they don't want to, that their wonderful, fearless leaders were lying to them. St. Tony Fauci, and he may, fortunately for himself, die before all this comes out. Maybe not. But it's terrible. And as I've told you on previous shows, I'm pretty convinced that you got a placebo. And lucky for you.
I don't know. Yeah, I just, you know, it's if I did, then it's only that I was able to by sheer chance. There's a lot of people, including some of the athletes who are the best conditioned people in the world, who are dying on the field of game and other things. I've heard a rumor, I shouldn't repeat rumors, that the wife of the prince in England, William, is vaccine damaged, that they're keeping that under wraps. Right, she hasn't been seen publicly. Recently, she was seen out with him doing some shopping, and now people who know them have said that was a double. And there, you know, if anybody doubts that, a lot of famous people have doubles. That's just part of what.
Well, more than what, that, the way she hasn't been seen since Christmas.
And that's right.
The latest thing is her next scheduled appearance was supposed to be the beginning of June or some whatever event, Now she's backed off from that. This is March 21st.
You don't even know if she's alive, frankly. I mean, I don't really want to talk about it. We don't know, so I'm not here to cast any rumors. But I only bring it up because, you know, the business of the potential damage of the vaccine is a real story. And it's one that is coming out drip by drip, as you say. Anyway, Mike, so what, do you have anything coming up? Yeah,
we're going to do more under the category of whatever happened to. The latest article was about Big Fanny and more.
Fanny is going to get pinched.
Yeah,
I mean, so. You know, your writing is getting very good, and it always was, but it's much more funny, and it's. I urge people to check out your
Well, thank you. I mean,
yeah,
it's more fun to write when I don't have to hold. I mean, not that I never really held back, but right. When I was on other forums, there was stuff that you just didn't want to go there.
Sure.
But now it's like you, once you've disconnected from YouTube.
What the hell? I'm now, it's like liberating. I can now say a few things. I'm not looking. Yeah, exactly. I'm not, you know, wondering, oh, you know, is this going to be the one that they take me down over?
Yeah.
And I thank Rumble for that. Rumble's a great site, and Rockfin and Getter and all these other people, you know, they have, my show is cooking along on all of them.
Oh, that's very good. And last thing, I guess, how's the book doing? And what about the next book?
The book is cooking along. You know, it's, I think that, like a lot of things that I've done, it is behind an algorithm. Amazon has let me know this because I think not for this book, but for the last book, I tried to actually spend a little bit of money on some promotion, and they've declined it. So that tells me that that I'm on their radar. They don't want to, you know, that they're suppressing my books. But even with that, and I'm not bringing it up to complain, I'm still fine. You know, the book is still moving along. And whatever, you know, I'm looking into other opportunities to stream the show. And I'm just, I'm not savvy when it comes to technology. It bores me and I don't really find it, you know, so I kind of go at it in spats of energy. But I'm moving along with it.
Oh, good. And you're going to have renewed and more energy with this vegan diet.
Oh, yeah. I already feel better. I mean, I'm doing this just
for... You may lose 30 pounds. I don't know.
I don't know. I might. You know, I mean, my daughter has wanted to do this, and she asked me if I would do it with her, and I am doing it with her. And it's no animal products, no dairy, no sugar, and very little bread. And... so far, so good. I feel better. I mean, it's like, you know, it's very energizing, and I think it is detoxing, and I'm all down with it. So I'll let you know how that goes.
All right. Well, keep up the good
work. All right, Mike.
We will talk to you on next week, Holy Thursday.
Indeed. Thank you.
All right.
God bless. All right.